From WNIJ, this is Under Rocks, where we investigate unique places, people, and happenings here in our backyard of Northern Illinois. I'm Spencer Tritt, joined by my co-hosts, Susan Stevens and Dan Libman, and we have a special mystery for you this month as we go down the rabbit hole of the Toynbee tiles. In the early 80s, these linoleum tiles started appearing on the East Coast, starting around Philadelphia, bearing strange messages about resurrecting the dead and creating an afterlife on the planet Jupiter. The tiles slowly spread across the Midwest, and one just recently appeared in Rockford, Illinois, right in front of City Hall. The identity of the tiler is a huge mystery, one that Philadelphia-based photographer Steve Weinick spent over a decade investigating. We'll talk with Steve later on about what he uncovered, but first, we head to Rockford to meet a local artist who tipped us off about the mystery of the Toynbee tiles.
So my name is Emily Grobe. I'm a local artist, and I also work at the Discovery Center, and I do all sorts of random creative things around town in Rockford. And I actually got roped into kind of this whole Toynbee tile mystery because I was part of an art show during Rockford Art Scene a couple months back, and a poet, actually the Rockford Poet Laureate, Adam Alciergany, he was doing this show where he would partner a visual artist with a poet, and then they would sort of collaborate on some sort of public art piece. And so the piece, I was partnered with him, and the piece that he chose was this Toynbee tile that had just very recently appeared in the streets of Rockford. And so we both kind of went down this crazy rabbit hole of what even is this thing? How did it end up in Rockford? Who makes them? And so he wrote a poem about it. And then from the inspiration of the original piece and the poem that he made, I created an art piece for the show, and all of it was on display during Art Scene, and it was a really fun time. But yeah, it sort of peeled back this veil of weirdness for this public art.
What was your art piece like? Did you make a tile?
No, well, okay. I sort of did. It was like, I made this, it's like 8 feet long, almost 6 feet tall, a few feet deep, but it was this installation sort of that looked like a big chunk of the road. And it was this piece of road, and I actually created magnetic grout because I wanted to have the ability to stick things to it because embedded in the road was a tile sort of inspired by the Toynbee tiles. And it was like a laser cut puzzle. And so all of the pieces were on the surface of the road, and then you could put it together and then form the message in the tile. So it was referencing, you know, both the poem by Adam and the Toynbee tiles. And it was a really fun project.
So some backstory here. Yes. We found out about the Toynbee tiles because you posted on Instagram a video about finding this tile on State Street, and you got like thousands of views on this video. What was it like having people reach out to you then? Did you know anything about the tiles before then? Tell us a little bit about putting out that video and the response.
Yeah, it was a really weird experience because as far as I knew, Adam and I were like the only people in Rockford that had any idea about this tile, because every person I asked, and I know quite a few like local artists, none of them knew anything about it or the history of the tiles, which I'm sure we're going to talk about. But yeah, it was super weird because then I had all of these people responding to the video just on a, oh, this is cool street art kind of level. But then I also had like DMs from people with like private pages and stuff who were like, someone close to the artist sent me this list of locations of tiles in Rockford, and don't publish them, but just so you know, these are the general locations. There's supposedly six tiles around Rockford.
Have you gone looking?
I have found a couple of them.
Okay.
But not all of them are Toynbee tiles. As far as I know, there's only the one Toynbee or Toynbee-inspired tile, and then the rest are pretty obviously done by another, of course, anonymous artist called House of Hades, who I believe are out of New York, or that they're believed to be out of New York. And they had, like, House of Hades' actual signature on them. So we know for sure that that Tyler was in Rockford, so I think it's not a big leap to assume that they also made the Toynbee tile, but... yeah, it was weird. There, I had a couple different messages like that from my post. It was shared far and wide, and I had another person who like writes a tile newsletter, and that person said that there's about 12 people in their tile hunting crew, and they're mostly on the East Coast because that's where most of the tiles are, but. They were like, if you want to be the Midwest correspondent, like, so
well, you
I
got a gig out of it.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's all just, you know, people finding stuff in the street.
Are you keeping the locations of these other ones secret?
I do have a list, but I'm not going to say where they are. Okay. And I also haven't found all of them. So I'm not, like, they're unconfirmed locations for the most part.
Can you sort of give us a hint? Are they in the streets? Are
yes.
They just sort of jets? They're all in the streets.
Yeah. So the way that the tiles work is that they're a piece of linoleum that have been sort of mosaiced together. Sometimes they're multiple colors, sometimes it's just one or two colors, and they're linoleum wrapped in tar paper and then believed to be injected with like asphalt sealant, and then they're thrown onto the street somewhat haphazardly, and then as the sun bakes on it and as cars roll over it, it gets embedded into the actual pavement, and it's believed, I think most of them are installed in the summer because that's when the road is softer. Mm-hmm. And so then as cars roll over it and it's embedded, eventually the tar paper will wear away, and then you get to the point where the message is actually revealed or the artwork or whatever it might be. So
that's interesting.
Yeah, so you don't actually... necessarily know. Like I've been racking my brain trying to figure out when this Toynbee was.
How long it's been sitting there before it was revealed.
As of August 2025, I found on Google Street View that you could see it in August, and I was scouring my camera roll from all of my pictures from Rockford Pride, which was June of last year, to see if I could find any pictures with it in there, but. I couldn't find any evidence of it in June. So sometime in the summer of last year is when.
Last year, okay.
Yeah, because it's worn away so you can see the message, but it's not deteriorated yet. And some tiles, like the ones that were installed, so the original Toynbee Tyler, who is anonymous, but there was a documentary where they made some claims about who they thought was the original Tyler, and obviously nothing has been confirmed, but their first tiles showed up in the early 80s in Philadelphia. And those, I think that there might be a couple surviving, so like they can last a really long time. But it really depends on the road conditions, if there's any construction. You know, some of them have been, like, if you find pictures online of these old tiles, like, you can see how they've been warped as they've been driven over. And
did the original person use this same method? Was this always?
Yes.
Okay.
So in the documentary, I think it's probably one of the most densely compiled bits of information about these tiles. This guy, Justin, who made the documentary, he... like was in Philadelphia living and had come across these tiles and became obsessed with it, I think, as most people who come across this information do, because there's just so many little mysteries to unravel. But he started, and this is pre like mainstream internet age, so he's just like walking around trying to find things out.
In the documentary, he Googles Toynbee tiles when his library first gets public internet, and there's zero search results.
Yes. So he's like one of the first people like looking into this or documenting it in any sort of like major way. And he was on some night walk sometime early in the morning and came across this huge, like, black blob in the street. And it was like he had come upon a tile like minutes after it had been installed. Yeah.
That was a great moment too in the movie. And he sits there with it until the sunrise, he says.
He's just like kind of hoping maybe he'd see the guy.
Yeah, right. Yeah, he runs around the block, he says, yelling out.
I believe.
Yes. Yeah, he's like, toy the idea, toy. Yeah. I guess we should probably explain that the tiles have a specific message on them.
My name is Steve Weinick. I work as a photographer and asset manager for a couple of arts organizations. Primarily, it's an organization called Monument Lab here in the city of Philadelphia.
The message here, the cryptic message that nobody quite seems to know what it means. There's references to Stanley Kubrick, 2001 Space Odyssey, burying the dead on Jupiter, and then Toynbee himself. So tell us a little bit about, kind of break down this, the cryptic message a little bit for us here.
Yeah, so I've worked with I'll back up a little bit and talk a little bit like how I know so much about these things. They were like a fascination for a lot of years. And in the early 2000s, I joined up with like a small team, three other guys in Philadelphia who are making a documentary. It just started a documentary project about this, and we like decided to figure out who was behind him and who was making him. So we uncovered a lot of information and figured out a lot behind them, including like finding source documents from the original Tyler and all of that. So when like I make crazy claims about what they mean, like believe me, like we actually have done the research.
Yeah, okay.
But the message itself is usually in four parts, and it's Toynbee idea in Kubrick's 2001 Resurrect Dead on Planet Jupiter. And as strange as it sounds, like this message was meant to be taken like 100% literally. The person behind them thought that he discovered a message in a book by the historian, British 20th century British historian Arnold Toynbee, that referenced a central idea and theme in Stanley Kubrick's 2001, that human beings needed to build heaven and space by physically resurrecting all people who had ever lived and ever died in outer space. I guess he assumed that, like, you know, that's a lot of people, so you need a big planet, and decided that Jupiter was probably the, you know, best place to do that. So, I mean, taken absolutely literally, he thought he uncovered an idea to build heaven in space by physically resurrecting the dead, by reassembling all of the, you know, disparate molecules that once made up each person, reassembling them through scientific means and, you know, creating a physical afterlife somewhere in outer space.
I have to say, like, to me, it, you go, oh, nonsense. But you know what? What makes that different from any other religion, honestly? When it comes to...
Now, something... Yeah, something that's come up like more recently, and like this is a message like that, you know, I've been like researching this for many years, but this is the thing that like really got me like reinterested in about a year ago. There was a 19th century movement in Russia. It was a philosophical movement, and they went by the name like Cosmos or Cosmism. And one of the leading proponents, I am not a Russian speaker, I cannot pronounce his name, but one of the leading like thinkers in this movement had a virtually identical idea of building a physical afterlife in outer space by reassembling the dead molecules of all human beings who had ever lived and building like a physical afterlife and creating physical resurrection in outer space. There is no evidence in any document or writing or anywhere at all that the Toynbee like Tyler person and had any inkling that the Russian Cosmos even existed. He seemed to come across that identical idea somewhat like independently.
Wow.
So yeah, I mean, 100 years earlier in a different place.
Yeah. And considering how he felt about Russians, according to some of the tiles, you know? Yeah.
That's fascinating. Real quick, more about the message on the actual tiles, too. There's little bits as well that are sometimes added along to the sides or on top of a tile that'll include all kinds of weird things, like you mentioned, instructions even on how to make the tiles.
Yeah. Often it was half thoughts or like half form thoughts or like bits of messages, or some of the more like paranoid messages came off in these side texts, like "murder every journalist, I beg you."
Oh, yeah. I'm not liking that one.
No, that's one.
And there was the one called the manifesto tile that is just a huge block of text. And like you said, kind of paranoid. So do you think this is all an elaborate art project, or is this legitimately a person who could be a little unhinged behind this?
Yeah, I think we discovered that it almost certainly, like when it started off, it was a person who was earnestly like trying to create like a movement that would, you know, gain steam and gain support and eventually lead to like this idea that he had to colonize outer space and build a physical afterlife on Jupiter. Wow. I have no idea. We were never, well, spoilers, but we were never able to actually speak with him directly. Mm. And I don't know if he noticed like that as he aged and maybe mellowed out a bit. I don't know if he noticed like the, you know, cult following that the tiles had started to develop and, you know, continue doing it regardless of whether or not he still believed it or not. But I think it started off like completely, totally, earnestly. Wow. And not as an art project. In the early days, in 1980 is when he had this idea or discovered this idea, he would say. And he spent the next several years like reaching out to media, reaching out to, you know, intellectuals and thinkers, like writing them letters, just trying to do outreach, and was rebuffed and rejected. And he thought that this was, I think, not just people not taking him seriously, but like an organized like suppression tactic used by the cult of the Hellion, as he called it.
He called into Larry King, like he was calling local radio and just being like, look, we've got to tell everybody about this.
Yeah.
Like we can do this and like bring this idea into reality. And he was pretty much laughed out of all traditional media platforms, which you can imagine people were not necessarily receptive to a little bit of a harebrained scheme like that. But I think that rejection made him extremely critical of traditional media. And so he started getting into shortwave radio, and he would you know, broadcast things on shortwave radio. He also, some of his neighbors reported, or well, the people who live around the area that they think that this guy lived, reported seeing this car that had no floorboards and a gigantic antenna on it. And they all had experienced like their TV signal being jammed and like having this Ooh. Audio like played over top of whatever it was that they were watching on their TV. And they would complain to this guy about it. So like it seemed like they were pretty sure it was him.
Yeah.
And his weird car with the giant antenna. And the floorboards being missing is, they assume, how he was able to place these tiles in the middle of streets without like just carrying around a giant.
He's just genius.
Yeah.
One of the most, you know, compelling pieces of information that we had was that there was a tile put down in Buenos Aires in the early 1980s, mid-1980s, that had an address in Philadelphia on it. So we, you know, went to that address a couple of times. We're never able to talk to the resident that lived there, but we did, you know, further investigation, talked to neighbors, uncovered other bits and pieces and clues. That before the tiles, there were handbills pasted all over Center City, Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And they advertised a shortwave station. So we went to a shortwave listeners conference that happened to be happening in the Philadelphia suburbs, like not long after we discovered, you know, that handbill information. We, you know, interviewed people there and talked to them, and someone actually remembered communicating with the person who was putting up those handbills.
Oh, wow.
We were able to, you know, like, use that information. They remembered a name, who was the name of one of our suspects. We were able to, you know, put things together. We, you know, found primary source documents. He was sending out, like, information packets and press packets to people that listened to him over shortwave. We were able to, you know, discover one of those that someone had, like, in the back of their closet for, you know, 35 years or however long it was at that point. And we were pretty conclusively, like, once we had, you know, that, that amount of information, able to, like, build on that and pretty conclusively discover who it was. Like I said, he never did speak with us and or talk to us, but, you know, through circumstantial and even, like, direct evidence, we're very confident in the conclusion.
I have to say the shortwave conference might have been my favorite part of the documentary. as a radio nerd. But as I was watching it, I was thinking, like, oh, they should have cut this part. Why did they just leave everything in this documentary? Where is this going? And then all of a sudden, oh, okay, someone turns around and I have some information. So, yeah, that was exciting. That was really cool.
It was amazing.
Yeah. So great reporting work following up on that, you know, that lead. And, you know, it was just like one step leading to the next. And also really compelling that neighborhood around that address had the test tiles.
Some characters. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was, you could tell where he was practicing and like the alley and the streets.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, once we got a little bit of information, people started opening up a little bit more, and they mentioned, oh, yeah, he drives a car and it doesn't have a floorboard on the passenger side. And it's like, well, of course, that's how he's putting him down. He pulls up in the middle of the night. Like I said, the tiles are just black packages of tar paper. You pull up to a red light, you drop one through the floor of your car, light turns green, you drive off. It's the middle of the night. No one is ever going to catch you. No one's ever going to see you, you know, putting him down. So that's how he was able to put them down, like, near the White House, outside the Lincoln Tunnel, or Holland Tunnel.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Genius.
Before that, yeah, we were imagining someone, like, well, they're, like, out here with a blowtorch for, like, 45 minutes or something. But no, he just pulled up, dropped it through a floorboardless car, and took off into the night.
Wow.
I was watching this with my brother, who knows art materials. And so he was like okay, so they've got to have a blowtorch and heat it up to this temperature for this long and then be able to push it, like, have, with, you know, really a lot of pressure to get it in. And then when it in the documentary, it showed like how he was like, oh, okay, that is so much easier. It's brilliant, and I gotta say it, and I'm sure we'll get to this soon, it's got to inspire others to do it, because I know I'm already thinking, like, oh, what could I put on a tile?
I know.
I'm wondering, okay, so he's going around, he's broadcasting this message, people are mailing for more information. Were there followers? Was this more than just, maybe he's the one putting the message out, the PR guy. Were there people also involved in this, do you think?
So he claimed that he was part of a group called the Minority Association, and he named a few other people in that group. And one short, I think, 6-sentence article that did get published in the Inquirer in 1983, Philadelphia Inquirer. Mm-hmm. But we never found any evidence that there was anyone else involved. He used two names in his documents. He used the name of the person who was our primary suspect, and he used a second name of someone who we were never able to conclusively prove actually existed. So we kind of assumed that, you know, that second name was sort of a public front to kind of distance himself from, you know, some of the things that he was doing, and also, like, give an air of, like, credibility to the organization, because, you know, the more people that are involved in it, you know, the more legitimate it would seem to be.
And unfortunately, but for some guy, that was a real person's name.
Oh, yeah.
Who you had to track. Yeah.
Yeah, there were a few people that had that name. One who was like of even remotely the correct age and the right area of the city. But yeah, that this person, there's never any even like shred or hint of evidence that he was involved in any way.
So we've talked this long and haven't mentioned who the person is who you believe is the Toynbee Tyler guy.
The Tyler.
The Tyler.
Yeah.
Are we allowed to reveal the suspected identity, or is that a secret?
Since he never actually spoke with us, like, directly, and he never, like, took involvement, it's easy enough to find if you, like, dig into it a little bit. Yeah. But, like, I don't usually, like, use his name just because he's still, like, technically has remained anonymous.
Okay.
So if you're really into it and you, like, really dig into it, you can figure it out. But if I just say a name, it's going to mean, nothing to anyone because no one really knows him personally. But, it could, I don't know. I usually don't say it.
Fair.
I just like refer to him as a Tyler. Yeah.
Okay. That's absolutely.
Remain the Tyler.
And is the Tyler alive still, as far as you know?
As far as I know, he is, yeah. Okay. He's getting up there in years, but yeah.
Well, that should lead us to this next bit here, which is the Tyler appearing all of a sudden in Rockford, Illinois, of all places. And I've heard a lot coming up in Chicago recently, I've noticed. Do you think, I know I don't have a picture of it or anything here for you, but how many of these that we're seeing today are real versus copycats, do you think?
Almost every single one that is appearing outside of, well, actually almost every single one, the last original style tile by the original Tyler that I know of was a set of three or four put down in Philadelphia in 2020. Since 2003, maybe 2004, 2005, 2006, there's been one primary copycat Tyler who's using that medium to spread his own message and also making like really faithful copycat tiles in the style of the Toynbee tiles. He is also anonymous, although he did approach and speak to Justin Doerr, who is the primary protagonist in Resurrect Dead, the documentary I've been talking about. When he approached him after a show that Justin played with his band, and he was in a wrestling mask. So he approached him, spoke with him, admitted who he was, but like remained like, anonymous.
Had the mask on.
Behind a
mask.
Yeah.
Wow.
But
that's amazing.
So he's still doing the Jupiter, the original message sort of stuff? Or does he have a different message?
He has his own message, which is House of Hades, and there's like they're called like the House of, we call them the House of Hades tiles, because usually there's a House of Hades message on it, and all types of different messages. Some of them are just mosaic images. Some of them are like abstract mosaics, and some of them are really faithful copycats of the original Toynbee tiles, especially like the 1990s era tiles. And he does a really good job. Believe it or not, like if you've seen the key image from the movie Resurrect Dead, which is Justin kind of sitting over a tile in the middle of the road, that's an image that we took with one of the House of Hades copycat tiles, just because it was the nicest example that we still had like remaining in Philadelphia at the time we were doing the promo photos for the movie.
Oh, interesting.
Okay, I had heard.
So they're nearly.
Yeah, I had heard of House of Hades while researching all this. So yeah, so that might be our primary copycat. That might be our artist in Rockford here.
Interesting. He didn't just go the spray paint route.
Right. Yeah, stencil spray paint.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he clearly had a very unique mind. So it's really, really interesting. And now obviously kind of as we've mentioned, there have been other Tylers that have been inspired by this work.
I'm thinking, I'm not going to ask any public works people, but I have a feeling like this is probably considered vandalism.
Probably. I mean, most street art is usually considered vandalism. I think different communities receive them differently. I think there are places in Philadelphia, I know, and probably in some of those other major cities like New York and stuff, where they've been actively preserved. And community members have like put notice out there, like, please, if you have to repave this road, let us know so we can extract it and save it before it's ruined. But I think the general attitude, at least of tile hunters, the people who are looking for these things, is to not call too much attention to them because they're afraid that city governments and things will step in and remove them.
Isn't this right in front of City Hall?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So three public radio reporters and an artist like hunched down on a pothole is gonna be.
Yeah, yeah.
We're about to find out what Rockford's attitude
I kinda
is
wanna see it.
Because we're not sure if it's there or not. We're about to go find out.
Yeah, okay. We can walk over there.
Let's do it.
As an artist, do you have a sense of how long it would take to create one of these?
I think it would take a long time. The type of linoleum that they're using, I've heard, is out of production now because it was, I don't quote me on this because I really don't know, but I've heard that it's like asbestos tile. Like it's this.
Oh shoot, I pulled up a bunch out of our basement. We could have, had I saved them.
Yeah, but it's like a thicker, sturdier linoleum than like the vinyl tiles that you get nowadays. So I think it's hard to find that material, but it's also very difficult to cut through. And so to create these, like, I mean, you're cutting letters that are smaller than an inch in a lot of cases out of this thick linoleum. It's got to take a really long time. And then you also have to have the other materials and the ability to install it in the road. And I just think it's probably pretty labor intensive to do a project like this.
So you can't just like wake up one morning and say, I'm going to put a tile down.
Well, I mean, if you already have all of the supplies on hand, maybe it doesn't take that long. But I think for someone who is just going to start doing something like this, there's a pretty big learning curve that you would have to overcome.
And it needs to be in a traffic place.
Yes.
It's got to be where the tires are going to go, so it can't be near the curb.
And that's why you don't see them on sidewalks either, because there's not, you would have to use a completely different method if you wanted to put it on the sidewalk.
Ideally, you don't have cars on sidewalks.
Yeah. We'll have to wait for the crosswalk, but you can see it right there in the middle by the...
Oh, yeah, look at that. Oh.
Holy
wow. Isn't it so
cool?
Holy
nuts.
Whoa.
Wow.
So, not to be too conspicuous about it, but we are stopping right in the middle of the road right now.
Wow.
I think we are going to become
the tourists. We drove right over it. That's why we didn't see
it. We were looking over there.
But you can see, I mean, like, it's perfectly flat and flush with the road. Like,
and it's night. It's really clear. And
yes.
I was kind of thinking it would be all scuffed up and dirty already, but it looks nice.
By my estimation, it's been there for about a year. I think that the constant traffic keeps it pretty clear, but eventually...
I'd worry about a plow going over it.
Yeah.
But it looks flush now.
It is, yeah.
So you could.
So it starts off as this like tarry envelope that gets thrown down on the ground, and then over time, at first, like when, if you look on Google Street View from August 2025, which is the last time they were through here, it's just black. It's completely black rectangle. Right. Yeah, so it's just so cool. And it's so small, and most people would never notice it. And it's really incredible.
No, it almost looks like someone dropped something on their way across and like, oh, a book or something.
Or a license plate or something.
Cool colors.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have to say, I don't know if this will come out, but I got really excited when I saw it. This is a... This is classic Under Rocks. Okay, let's go.
Right? It's so neat. It would be super cool, though, like, for more people to be hunting for tiles, obviously in a respectful way that's not destroying any art or calling undue attention to it so that it might get removed. But it's just such a fun thing to do, and I think it makes you be a little bit more present in your travels around the city. You gotta keep an eye out for little little bits of magic.
If somehow the Tyler decided he wanted to get in touch with you, you know, meet in a, on a park bench somewhere, what would you say to him?
Oh, man. I have no idea. Like, I would have to get a read of, like, his personality, I think, first and see what...
True.
Okay, it's daylight. You're okay.
It. Yeah. Now, I would... Man. I don't want to say, like, oh, I'd ask if he'd seen the movie and what he thought of it, but I would definitely be curious about that.
Yeah.
I feel like
does he know he's been hunted down? Like, yeah.
I'd apologize for any, like, you know, attention that might have, like, come his way because of it. So we you know, went out and decided we wanted to figure out this mystery. We had no idea where it would lead. If we doubted we'd even figure out anything about it, we like identify who this person was, and if we did, we thought, oh yeah, it might just be an art project, it might just be, you know, someone's, like, you know, quirky side hobby or whatever. But what we ended up finding after 5 or 6 years of, you know, research, this thing took forever to make and produce, was someone who didn't actually want to speak with us. And we kind of, like, we sat down at that point, we're like, well, what do we do now? Like, do we, you know, finish this film and release it or not? And we decided, yeah, let's finish it, release it. Then the movie got, you know, way bigger than we ever expected. It got into the Sundance Film Festival. It premiered there in 2011. So we thought it would maybe be at a smaller film festival somewhere, be seen by, you know, a few super fans and, you know, just people randomly. But it got picked up by one of the largest festivals in the world and got real distribution, was on Netflix for a while. So I think I would apologize for any, like, anything that might have come his way that he wasn't asking for.
Yeah.
As far as, like, questions, I do feel like we've answered a lot of those questions. I maybe just want to confirm that, like, our theories were correct. But
Well, at the beginning of our talk, you mentioned that you had kind of gotten back interested in the tiles again just in, like, the past year. What got you back into it after taking some time away?
Yeah, so that was the thing, like, I was about to say. Actually, I was like, no, I'd ask him about, like, the Russian Cosmos and if he's ever heard of it.
Yeah.
And that was it. It was the Russian Cosmos. And, you know, this was something that came up, like, during, like, some period of research, but it didn't grab me at the time, like, many years ago. But for whatever reason, I was listening to an interview with a cosmism scholar named George Young. I don't think I listed where he teaches, but he's a professor in the United States. And he described the ideas of, again, like, I wish I knew how to pronounce his name, Fyodorov, Nikolai Fyodorov, a Russian cosmist. His central idea was the idea that not only are we able to, but we must travel to distant planets and colonize those planets. His reason for it was connected to a single great idea that everything we do must be connected to a project of restoring life to all the dead, the idea of resurrection. This is an active version of the Christian idea. God gave us that job to do. The exploration of outer space was part of this religious task, which was to go outside the earth to recover the particles, the dispersed particles of ancestral dust.
Wow.
This is something written by the Toynbee Tyler in the early 1980s. It encloses a copy of our press release that we were giving to all media to publicize Arnold Toynbee's conception of the colonization of outer space as depicted in the movie 2001 Space Odyssey, on the ability of science to bring every dead molecule of every dead human body of every dead human being that has ever lived in history back to life on the gigantic planet of Jupiter. This is when humanity climbs the next ledge of evolution, and at this point we can do anything that God could do and are able to fulfill all those big promises that God has made about what the afterlife would be. Wow. So, like, those are, you know, really similar ideas. And I would, going back, that's what got me reinterested recently when I ran across, like, that interview. And that is definitely what I would want to ask the Tyler about if he, like, had ever, heard of Russian cosmism.
Wow.
I think this point was made earlier, but it's worth repeating. It's like, you know, this idea seems really, really, like, kind of out there and wacky. But, like, if he had been born 100 years earlier in a different place, like, you know, he'd be among the intellectual, like, vanguard. So you never know.
Yeah.
Right.
Do you know what the Tyler did for a living?
Well, this is something we discovered afterwards also, but at least one job he had was converting vehicles. I forget what type of vehicle, but have you ever seen like a sedan that gets like cut down and turned into like a like sort of little pickup truck?
Oh, yeah.
And cut off like the back section of it.
I want one.
So he would do like those conversions. He would also do sign painting on the sides of vehicles.
Oh.
So those two skills.
Yeah.
You know, between the painting of signs, the modification of cars, like, you know, that right in line with
yep. Checks out.
Transferable skills.
Yeah.
Amazing. Okay. Yeah. All right.
This has been so cool. Thank you so much, Steve.
Yeah.
And we should mention you run a website too, toyandbeideas.com. Did I get that right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
toyandbeidea.com. You've got a lot of cool resources on there, blog. There's even a sheet like of how you can tell a copycat apart from an original, I think, on there that I saw. A lot of cool info. So definitely recommend people check out your website. And the documentary is on YouTube and it's a full length. It's a really cool documentary. And thanks so much for talking with us today, Steve.
Thank you so much. And
yeah.
We'll see you on Jupiter.
We'll see you on Jupiter, Steve. All right.
Thank you.
And thanks to you for joining us for another Under Rocks investigation. It just seems like the more you dig, the more you find out about these Toynbee tiles. A special thanks to Steve Weinick for talking with us, and to Emily Grobe from Rockford for tipping us off about this mystery and showing us the tile in Rockford. Go over to WNIJ.org where you can find some pictures of the tile and links to the documentary and Steve's website. And hey, if you have an idea for what we should investigate next here in our region, send us an email, rocks@niu.edu. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you on Jupiter.